Hey guys, Brad here. A couple of things. First, we only have a couple more episodes before we're going to go on our break for the holidays. So in the last episode of this season, we're going to make a pretty exciting announcement. So stay tuned for that. And second, being that I edit these episodes, it'd be real easy for me to always paint myself in a really good light. You could say that I have the power to make these sound however I want. However, in this particular episode, I left in a portion of this where I don't come across in a very good light. I use a pretty harsh tone when speaking about these statements of faith that we're talking about today. And I want you to know that if you listen to this and you're starting to get pretty upset with me, first of all, I understand. And second of all, I ask that you stick with me to the end, where I attempt to clarify what I said and acknowledge where I was wrong. With that being said, let's go ahead and get into this episode about statements of faith.
I was trying to swallow. Just before doing that?
Yeah.
I almost died. I almost gave my life for that intro.
You know, I've heard some feedback. I think our listeners miss the how, and we've actually had some episodes where it didn't go down, and I felt like something was missing as well.
I thought for a second you were going to say you heard from listeners, and they said they want me to die.
No, that didn't happen. Although after this episode, I mean, who knows? Maybe we'll hear that. I don't think anybody has a death threat for you. Now, Brad, on the other hand, I could see that.
Yeah, I get quite a few death threats, but that's just from, you know, just random people. It has nothing to do with the podcast. They just think I need to know that they want me dead.
Isn't it more of your day-to-day? Like, you're,
right,
so just, Brad's a project manager. He's constantly just badgering people to do things for him, which is the freaking worst. And that's why we have him in his role for our podcast, so that we'll actually get something done.
Yep. Right. Brad is our podcast badger.
You know, I was thinking about, as I was driving, from an evolutionary standpoint, or from like a primal urge standpoint, we have this almost innate skill set to dominate other creatures, right? So, like, I think at the beginning of time, not the beginning of time, but in early human existence, we had to hunt. You know, we didn't go to the grocery store. But now, unless you make a concerted effort to actually, I don't know, gather or hunt or kill something for a reason, that desire kind of lies dormant. And
to murder?
Not to murder, but to best another creature on this earth. You know, like, I don't do a lot of hunting is basically what I'm saying. We live in southern Mississippi. I grew up in Oklahoma. You would think that I would know how to go hunting, but I have zero skill. I'm terrible at it.
Have you tried hunting?
A little bit, in the sense that when I was a kid, Daniel and I would be on my grandpa's farm, and we'd shoot at turtles because he said the turtles were eating all the fish that he actually had put in the pond, and so that was the justification for it. Daniel was a much better shot than I was. I just shot the water. Like, maybe I killed something, but it definitely wasn't any of the turtles. So with anything, you need practice. Right? Like, you have to hone a skill. Well, I'm a homeowner, and I heard some noises in the attic. More importantly, my wife heard some noises in the attic and said, "David, I think there's something up there living," you know? So I go up there, I check, and I see these little bitty tiny turds. And apparently these tiny turds, depending on the size, are either like mouse turds or rat turds.
Or very small babies.
Or very small. What? All right, so.
You almost went with it.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I put up some traps. Fast forward, shoot, to the next day. Doesn't work for me at all. It's because I put mouse traps up there and I don't have the knowledge.
Rookie mistake.
I don't have the knowledge to know what kind of turds I'm dealing with. You know? So we call in the big boys. Shout out to Havard Pest Control. This really nice guy comes up, basically helps educate me on the battle of my life that's happening right now.
David's obviously had a really hard life.
I've had a tough one, man. I've had a tough life. So he hooks me up with some traps, shows me how to bait them, tells me to go get some Slim Jims.
How good are you at baiting those traps now? Would you say you're a master?
Not a master. Definitely not a master at baiting the traps.
You're not a master baiter.
I'm not.
Okay.
I knew it was going there, and I just let it happen. Story of my life. So he teaches me how to bait it, and he says, "Hey, man, good luck. Call me if you have any issues." He put out some like poison traps, not traps, but like poison kind of stations outside of the house as well. Told me how to like close up this hole that I had in the attic, so I closed that up, and then he said, you know, good luck. So y'all, I know you're wanting to know who's winning in this battle. You know, are the rats besting me, or am I taking the rats out? I'm gonna tell you, even though y'all don't seem super interested, y'all, David 2, rats 0.
Nice.
I've taken out 2 so far. And I'm not
going
to lie.
Wait. How do rats get points? Do they have to kill a member of your family?
No. So for
that
me,
ups the stakes of this battle drastically.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we're working with Southern Mississippi rats. And these things are not tiny. And they're vicious. And they're smart. And they'll do anything for food. Unlike us, because we get to go to a grocery store and just buy what we need. So I take out the first one, and I'm like, heck yeah, man, this is awesome. So I go up, I basically take the mouse out of the trap, fast forward to that.
It's a mouse now?
Sorry, the rat, out of the trap.
It was a tiny little mouse.
It was a tiny, tiny mouse. No, so fast forward to that evening after the first kill, and I hear this, like this crazy noise. Hannah looks up. We're both like, what the heck was that?
He's pantomiming right now.
Y'all, the Rat King was pissed.
Did you become the Nutcracker?
The Rat King was expressing his anger and frustration because I took out Jimmy or whoever I killed and made the most noise I've heard in my attic to date. It was terrifying. Like, I am fearful of my adversary. So next morning, I start going up. Like, I basically get the stairs down to walk up and look inside the attic. And my thought when I got to the top was, he's going to jump at my face. I'm going to panic and I'm going to fall. And Hannah's going to cash in my life insurance policy. And it's going to be 1-1. And I got a broken neck. I was very nervous. Came up there with a flashlight. Luckily, he didn't attack me. And a baseball bat. And a gun. I bought a gun to fight these rats. I got number 2, but when I went up there for number 2, there was this smell, and there were these creatures that were wiggling because the other rats started eating Billy, who I just killed, because I didn't get him out of my attic quick enough. And so it was really, really disturbing.
How long of a gap of time was that?
I think it may have been 2 days. So I guess the lesson here is you got to check those traps daily, because rats will go to town on whatever food source is there. And I think because I closed up the attic, maybe there was a family there, and the family now can't get other food. And y'all, they went cannibal.
You're saying you made Lord of the Flies Rat Edition.
I think maybe I did. So that's where we are right now with the rat story.
So think now.
It's ongoing.
You probably have to call that second rat Piggy, right?
You heard it here. You heard it here. And everything is okayers or whatever we're calling y'all. If you want to give us some tips on how we should name future rats, please let us know. If you are basically the rat hunter and have plenty of experience, please let us know what I need to do, because it's a slow, methodical process, but I don't know how many there are in there. I don't know when it's going to end.
Check those traps daily.
Check those traps daily. You heard it here.
It's very important.
Yeah,
you know, they
and make sure with the poison that is outside that your dogs cannot get to that.
They can't access it.
But they can access poisoned rats.
Well, yeah,
it's possible.
It's because I say that because, you know, our dog, our lovely dog, got into some mouse poison. And I just happened to be home and see it. And that can be some pretty, it'll kill them for one, but two, it can be pretty disturbing how they would die if you didn't get it treated. So be sure to keep your dogs away, because it's something that they would like. Like, it tastes good to them. So anyway.
It's because it's candy corn flavor, which is what we bought since it's October.
Right.
Right.
So that's our morbid Halloween edition of
If there's one thing
okay.
rats like, it's a theme.
It is. They do value a theme. I love that. So that's my story for y'all. Brad, go ahead and cut it. I love it because Brad's right now, he's like looking at the time and he was like, it's another long David story. I don't know if we're going to keep it. I don't know. So
no, I actually don't know how long that story was. I didn't know.
It was longer than it needed to be, which is apparently the story of my life.
Next nice. Episode, remind me to tell the story of the New Yorker whose dog passed away.
That is a very good story. Brad.
Okay.
All right.
Well, Brad, it's on you.
Okay. I will probably forget, but I'm going to do my best.
So I'm going to segue us real quick.
Okay.
I think it's interesting when we, for whatever reason, I assume that we're wired this way. And I think, like, from a neurologist standpoint, we probably are, at least from the information that they have. But it's very easy for us to put things in categories, right? To put things in the binary. Us versus them, me versus the rats. You know, I apparently my life is more important than the rat's life. They moved in. My attic is the rat hotel. I step up to the challenge and I'm taking them out one at a time because they are my enemy.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like one of your mistakes might have been challenging anything to a fight to the death, because you said you're not a good hunter. So you're saying I'm not good at this. But they hunt all the time. And
they
you
do.
Challenged them to a fight to a death.
I
to
did,
death.
Man.
That's
and
a terrible idea.
It's a terrible idea, but they're not paying the mortgage, James. They're not paying the mortgage.
You're going to wake up and there's going to be a rat on your chest staring in your eyes. He's right. Going to be wearing a crown, have a scepter.
That is my deepest, darkest secret fear.
He's going to have a candy corn in the other hand.
So scared.
Because he
right?
loves a theme.
Stop. Stop it right now.
He's just going to slowly take a bite of the candy corn and then set it down and walk away. I hope you dream that.
This is our 5-minute segue. And I will dream it tonight, James. Thank you. So it's easy for us to put things into basically a category of good or bad, in or out, and to put our different identities potentially in those different camps. And I think about a topic that Brad, you brought up that you wanted to talk about today. And I think that there is a tribal component to a lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is that. There's definitely a lot of in versus out. You know, one of the most common things you'll hear is United States good, basically the entire Middle East bad. You know, we're fighting evil. We're going after evil. You hear that all the time. Now, you can argue whether or not we're actually the good guys, but but for the sake of this, you hear that a lot. You know, it's always good versus evil. That really became super popular after 9/11, right? Because
that was such an easy sell, because
yeah.
We were devastated because we lost
right.
our friends, our family on our quote unquote soil.
Right.
And for one of the, not the first times, but one of the more recent times where we saw bipartisanship, right? We saw both sides of the aisle coming together to be like, we have a shared enemy and we need to do something about it.
Right. So, this episode is actually basically the first episode in a series of three we're going to do. We had been talking for quite a long time about, you know, different topics, different things that were just kind of rattling around in our brain. And one of those topics is what we're going to speak of today. And that is essentially the need that the church feels to quote unquote defend the faith, and specifically through these public statements that seems to be popular nowadays, with, you know, pastors signing these big declarations of statements.
So what would be an example of one of those?
Yeah, so I mean, there's two main examples, and the one that comes to my mind first is the Nashville statement. And for those who don't know what the Nashville Statement is, this came out, oh gosh, what would you say, like 6 months ago, maybe a year ago at this point?
That sounds about right.
It's been
more than 6 months.
It's been a minute. And what the Nashville Statement is a group of evangelical Christians basically felt the need to define gender to them and sexuality. There's a lot of language such as evangelical Christians find themselves living in a period of historic transition. You know, we're becoming increasingly post-Christian, which could be a whole nother probably episode on itself on what the heck they mean by that. But essentially what the Nashville Statement is, it's a series of articles. There's 14 of them. And what these articles are is a we affirm statement and we deny statement.
So binary again.
Right.
I wanted to pose a quick opening question to you and James. Why do you think evangelical Christians, Western Christians, feel the need to defend or to create these artificial borders, which is what, when you, all right, so the Nashville Statement, just from what you just talked about, is clearly a stance or a defensive stance to let people know who's in the in group, who's in the out group. And my question is, why?
Well, to me, I think it all boils down to the issue of how they view the Bible, how they view Jesus, why Jesus died, you know, what is salvation, what does that entail, what is their mission. I think that there's an underlying thing there. I also think that there is a level of underlying power, and in that they feel that they're losing ground, and because they feel they're losing ground, they feel like they need to basically go on the defensive. That's my opinion. But I honestly, I'm becoming more and more baffled by it, because I don't really understand what their purpose is, other than, to me, seems like it's just being hateful. They're going to phrase it like they love these people, and that's why they're making these statements, but it just doesn't come across that way. And I'm becoming increasingly weary of it all the time.
Yeah.
I would say that a large part of why they would claim that the statements were made would probably be the fact that Paul said, be ready to give a defense for the hope that's within you. I feel like that's something that's used as an excuse, but I also feel like the timing of it may in large part be because evangelicals were losing ground in the battle of morality.
Of what?
A battle of morality. And I say that because a large number of white evangelical pastors and whatever all voted for Trump. They were supporting someone when a lot of people came out against him, saying, how can you be for someone who's making statements that make it sound like he's advocating sexual assault and other such things that you've so thoroughly been against for so long? Affairs, multiple marriages, all these things that you would actively condemn all the time, but you're supporting this person and saying this is God's chosen person for leading the country and all of that stuff, and backing him so thoroughly that to try to regain their position as the moral majority, they made these statements instead of actually living any of it out.
So, I mean, do you think the motivation is more the need to state what you believe, or the need to declare what you're against? Like, which do you think is the bigger motivation there? Because they say affirm and deny, but do you think it's more we're taking a stand on what we believe, or do you think it's we're making sure we let you know what we're against, or both?
I think from a what's going to sell, what's going to get people in the pews, what's going to get people tithing to my church, it's a much stickier idea to talk about what you're against and to have some sort of group or some sort of differentiation to either hate on, or if you don't like to explicitly hate, to at least feel good about yourself because you're not that person, or you don't handle these situations this way, or that you were born a male or a female, or you were born straight and, well, you've apparently opted into that, or you chose to be straight. So that's clearly God's plan, because we put all of our faith into these books, at least in evangelical Western Christianity. And so, yeah, no, I think it's absolutely fear-based, so that we can make sure that we still have some sort of group that we can be proud of. And I mean, the thought of like, oh, well, everybody gets in is really offensive. You know, this, oh, everybody inherits the kingdom of God, or, oh, Jesus died for everyone. Whoa. I'm the one that prays five times a week. You know, I'm the one that tithes 10%. I'm the one that follows this, and this. So I inherit the kingdom of God. That person doesn't.
I mean, I feel like there's a lot of difficulty because it's easy to condemn all of the people who are doing this as selfish and jerks and whatever. It's very easy to point the finger and decide they're bad guys. But just like we were saying before, there's not that binary. Just because in this realm, they might be our enemy or whatever, does not make them bad. So that's definitely something I wanted to say.
Who are you referencing there?
The people who wrote and signed the statement.
Hmm.
So I think the thing that I found really compelling, you know, a lot of podcasts that I've listened to, a lot of different speakers I've been listening to, there's a lot of things that have been coming out about the story in the Bible about the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very compelling story. And the more you kind of unpack it, the more it becomes even more compelling. But there was a part in that, I don't remember if it was the liturgists, if it was Rob Bell, if it was who I was listening to.
So just heretics that you're listening to.
Yeah, pretty much. Cool. You know, if it was who it was that was talking about it, but he got to talking about, it was the liturgists. It was on, you know, one of those, they were talking about evangelical world. And, you know, in the story, you know, a lot of people know the story. The younger son decides that, you know, he wants his inheritance now, gets his inheritance, goes off, blows it, lives with pigs, eventually goes back thinking his father's going to hate him. Not only does his father not hate him, but is waiting on him, throwing a party for him, giving him his coat, all of that. And everybody knows that side of the story, but they got to talking about the side of the older brother and how the older brother got frustrated when the younger brother came back because he said, but I've always been here. I've always been faithful. I've always, you know, I didn't run off. I didn't try to get my inheritance. I was the good son, essentially. And the way they were wording it is a lot of the evangelical world feels in a lot of ways that they're like, it's like they're the older brother.
Sure.
And they're saying, but we've been here and we've been faithful and we haven't, I don't know, we've made these stances for you, and yet we're hearing that you're for the person who ran off and just didn't care, and then now they've come back and you accept them with open arms as if nothing happened, you know. And I just love the way that what I love about it is that the father turns to that older son and says, but all of this is yours. You know, all that I have is yours. So basically saying, I died for you too, and this is all yours. And good job. You stuck with me and you did, you know, what you felt was right. But and this is yours too. I died for you too, you know, and I just wonder if like we lose sight of that. We almost feel like we have to prove that we've been the faithful one. So when the Nashville statement first came out, I was definitely upset about it. One, because I disagreed with most of the things they were saying. But definitely the famous article in this is Article 10. In these articles, it's lining out, you know, Article 1, God designed marriage to be covenatal, sexual, procreative, lifelong union between a man and a woman, husband and wife, meant to signify the covenant love between Christ and the church. But we deny that God has designed marriage to be homosexual, polygamous, polyamorous. We also deny that marriage is mere human contract. And it starts with that. And then it goes into, you know, we believe that God made man, woman, male, female only. There is no such thing as, you know, transgender, all of that. And then becomes Article 10. And it was, we affirm that it is sinful to approve of homosexual immorality or transgenderism, and that such approval constitutes an essential departure from Christian faithfulness and witness. Basically saying, if you're affirming of homosexuality, you're not a Christian. And I know that because they got asked, is this what you're saying? And they doubled down on it and said, yes, that's definitely what we're saying. And initially, when that statement came out, that's what hacked me off. And I was like, okay, so you just called me not a Christian. My initial visceral reaction was, how dare you? But as time has gone on, I've determined that that's not what I'm upset about. What bugs me about this statement and other conversations that I seem to get in from time to time is if somebody just flat out disregards or denies fact or reality, like I'm at a loss.
So what are you referencing there?
So by saying that there is only a binary of male and female is just wrong. There is a group of people. In fact, you can go on Netflix right now. There's a show put out by BuzzFeed, and one of the episodes, they're following around asexual people, essentially hermaphrodite people.
Right.
People who, again, if you want to listen to the Liturgist podcast, episode 20 is on the LGBTQ community. Starting at minute 16, there is a whole section in there about the science of sexuality, and he goes into how gender gets formed. But there are scientific evidence and documented cases of people who could be born with male genitalia but have female chromosomes, who, you know, have a underdeveloped, what they call a micro penis and testicles that have never came out of their body.
Right.
But they look female, but they are male. So to say that there is only a binary and it's all based on genitals it's just factually wrong.
Right.
And so with that, that's what hacks me off is I understand that the Bible says male, female, but they didn't have science and they didn't have this at the time. So to now deny that, and I'm not saying you have to approve, the fact that they don't approve of homosexuality is a whole nother deal, but the fact that they deny the reality of people, that's what hacks me off the most about that statement. And that's what gets me fired up when it comes to having these discussions. You know, and I even just read an article yesterday that the administration now is trying to literally do away with the category of transgender and say that it is a binary.
That's basically based on your birth certificate. Yeah, your birth certificate, what they specify. And it's interesting because physicians and parents have to make that call if their infant is born with unspecified genitalia or both. And many parents will make a determination at birth to either go to have surgery, knowing the ramifications are so negative for a person in our society. I mean, frankly, in probably every society, to have either ambiguous sexual genitalia, to have a micro penis or an enlarged clitoris. Like, that's difficult, for sure. And I have empathy for parents that have to make that determination. And it's so interesting because when we were in middle school and high school and learning about sexuality and, I mean, even human biology, this wasn't something that I was taught about. Did y'all have any knowledge or anything? Did you learn about any of this in your formal education?
No. I mean, that's one, for sure, one reason why so many people think that it doesn't exist. Right. They weren't taught that that's even a possibility. Mm-hmm. And then so they look at Genesis and see male and female. And so, well, that must be it. So, yeah. I mean, I think that's a large part of it, is just that there was no education on it. And that's one reason why the education system has been tried to be controlled so much, with not allowing evolution in and anything like that. Because if you don't allow it to be taught in school, it's not real. You know, right. It's like they used to say back in the day, if it wasn't in the newspaper, it didn't happen. It's the same type of thing.
Yeah.
Right. And I equate it to the same thing as, I don't know, I couldn't tell you how severe, say, something like global warming is, but the data shows what it shows. Like, data is data. It's not biased. It's data. So, like, to have somebody go, well, that's just not a thing. Well, open your eyes and look at it. Like, and it is a thing.
I will say, there's probably some people listening that hear you say, well, data is data, and they're like, well, no, interpretation of data can obviously have bias, and they would be right, but...
Yes, you can skew it, but what I'm saying is, like, yeah. Raw numbers is raw numbers. Like, raw temperature is raw temperature. Like, that's not...
Dude, raw egg is raw egg. Absolutely.
Yeah, so...
I mean, for these times that I've had conversations about the potential that there's not a binary, and being able to give percentages of how many people are born with ambiguous genitalia or whatever those systems are, and stories of all the different people who don't have XX or XY, like XXY or whatever all the combinations are, they say, yeah, but that's a disorder. So that doesn't count as a different gender or anything. There's a disorder.
And, well, so is red hair.
I'm not trying to defend it. I'm just saying that's the route that a lot of people go. When then accepting that there's data, we'll say, yeah, but that doesn't get to be anything outside of a binary. That's a disease or disorder or whatever that has caused that.
It's interesting that you say red hair, because the best estimates that they have is that there is about the same number of people with gender ambiguous genitalia as people that have red hair. It's about the same percentage. That's their estimates. About 1 in 1,000.
Wow.
I'll say, that's really interesting. I understand, and I've definitely been there many times with being really upset and offended by these statements, or aspects of them at least. But think of what Christianity was thought of, like the things that were Christianity when we were kids, when we've talked about it so often, that like foundationally things that we were taught were don't be gay, don't drink, don't cuss. Salvation has nothing to do with works. It's all grace, and you know, so many of these different aspects like that. And people are going through deconstruction in huge numbers. And so people are re-examining what Christianity is. And these two statements both address all of the things that we were taught Christianity was. It feels like there are people who can't adapt or re-examine what their faith is. It's people who have absolute certainty that they have it all right. And so when Christianity starts to move away from, even using biblical examples, moving away from what they taught Christianity as, they hold on tighter. And then make statements like the Nashville statement where it's like, no, it's about this. And if you don't agree, you're not a Christian. Somehow, Christianity in that venue now is nothing to do with Jesus and everything to do with what you've decided the Bible says, but Jesus never said himself. And so, like, with the model of this is exactly what marriage has to be, and that's it. Nothing else is allowed. It's not a governmental contract or whatever the language is, but it's a covenant with God. No, originally it was a business arrangement. It was selling women to men. That's what marriage was.
Well,
selling women to men
to get land and wealth and anything else in addition to said woman.
Right. And that was that was part of the that was the other part of the deal.
Yeah,
they were selling women to people, though. Yeah. That's what marriage was.
And if that woman couldn't conceive, then what would you do?
Screw someone else.
Right.
That's just the way it worked. They had a lot of systems set up where if I just get somebody else pregnant, we can just say it's hers. Like,
right.
Just get one of our slaves pregnant and she gets him. Like, that's the way it works. So don't make the claims, especially looking at church history, that marriage is one man, one woman, because that eliminates a lot of the church fathers from the Old Testament. A lot of them. That really messes, like, I mean, there's 12 tribes of Israel. That doesn't even work out. There's like, what, four moms in that situation? Anyways, I'm saying a lot of these statements seem to be people saying, no, we had it right, and you can't change anything. Because the more recent statement was the one on talking about social justice and trying to make sure they establish that social justice is not an aspect of Christianity, which is amazing. Because that's what most of Jesus' life was.
Right. They even threw in the title, it's not just a statement on social justice. It's a statement on social justice and the gospel. They went all out on that one.
Right. Because the gospel in that area is viewed as Jesus died on the cross, then rose again. So the gospel is 3 to 4 days. For some reason, when you read the Gospels, the majority of that's irrelevant, I guess. Because there's just a few chapters on him dying and coming back, but a whole lot of him talking about things and teaching people stuff and giving a lot of commands that apparently are irrelevant to the Gospel.
So we're going to take just a quick break. And then we'll dive into that topic.
Moment of, you know, peeling back the curtain, a moment of admitting my flaws and things of that nature. As we were sitting here in this break, I really got to thinking about what I had said previously about the statements, making statements like facts are facts, things of that nature. And I wanted to clarify something. By saying it that way, I was essentially taking the tone that I think frustrates me about these statements. I was doing the same thing. And I want to walk back on that a little bit and admit that I didn't come at that with the proper humility. The way I said that made it sound like I think that I am 100% in the right and they are 100% in the wrong. And I know that that's not, you know, I know at least in my case, I'm not 100% in the right. So with that, I acknowledge that I approached that a little harshly, arrogantly in some respects. So I do acknowledge that. What I was trying to say is it's hard to have a conversation when the realities of life and the realities of, say, what science has uncovered over the years since the time of when the Bible was written, it's hard to have a conversation if the person you're having a conversation with just totally denies that, even with all the evidence in the world. And you say, listen, this is a thing. There, gender is not binary. It's just not. And then you present those facts. And if somebody goes, no, that's just not a thing. The Bible says this and this. It's hard to have a conversation. And there's a frustration in that came across. And so I wanted to admit my wart. And now we can, you know, keep going with this talk. But I wanted to make sure that I acknowledge that I probably didn't come across very good there. So
I think one of the challenging things about having a discussion over the Nashville Statement is that I assume a lot of our listeners are re-examining Christianity as they were brought up to know Christianity. And I can't speak for everyone, but for a large majority of them, it may have been in the evangelical church. Maybe it was Baptist, maybe it was Presbyterian Church of Christ. But like one of the aspects that stuck with Brad, James, and myself that has been challenging to continue to believe, at least for myself, is that the Bible is God breathed in the sense that God wrote the Bible almost using humans' hands, but like explicitly having this divine, like, boom, this is exactly verbatim how I want you to write it in Hebrew or Greek. And that when people then translate that Bible, I'm going to also work through them to make sure that we just have one English version, King James. That's the version that you have to, line up with and just believe it verbatim that, it's not allegory or storytelling or not multi-layered. And actually, it's literal and inherent, inerrant. I can speak for myself and say that, like, I'm not there at all. But now, looking at the Bible, this collection of books, as a group of humans that were trying to communicate with other people about the God of the universe and the story of how they interacted with God, tried to become better than maybe their natural inclinations would have them be, that they struggled, that none of them were perfect, that there was this group of followers that followed Jesus of Nazareth and thought he was going to be this Messiah king that then overthrew their oppressors and like transformed their existence from being the have-nots to the haves. Like, I can connect with that. Like, that's compelling. That's inspiring. Mm-hmm. And for me, moving from thinking the Bible is the end-all be-all to a place of like, the Bible is sacred and can teach me so much about 2018 when it was written thousands of years ago is fascinating. It makes Christianity still compelling. It makes it fascinating because I realize there are so many layers to these ancient books. There's so many layers to these characters, regardless of whether or not they exist or not, is for me, is not a deal breaker. It's still very exciting. It doesn't make me doubt God's existence or doubt Jesus of Nazareth's existence if Adam and Eve was a story or literal fact. And when I look at, to tie it back into this conversation, I know that seems a bit like a tangent, I look at these men and women who came together with these statements, and I see them trying to defend the authenticity or legitimacy of the Bible in these specific statements. I'm just like, why? I get why, but I'm what's the end game here? Do y'all really think that you're losing the culture? And I guess they think the church is dying, and they think this is something that's going to keep it alive. I don't know.
I'd say those things are true, though, right? The church is losing people, and the way that the people who wrote and signed this view scripture, they are losing culture. Those views have been losing people really quickly.
Right.
So I wouldn't say they're wrong. Like, I completely understand the fear, the worry, and everything. And I want to believe, and I do believe, that they are not trying to be oppressive. They're not trying to be mean or anything like that. I think that they genuinely feel like the way they see Christianity is right, and that because so many people don't agree with them right now, that all of those people are going to burn for eternity. I mean, that's what it comes down to, right? Like, that's their belief. And so, in desperation, they do things like make these statements where I don't see how that making these statements would help or fix any of it. It just seems like drawing a line in the sand, and instead of trying to figure out how to be evangelical, like really be evangelists of their belief system, they drew a line in the sand and said, none of y'all are in.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like literally the opposite of evangelism.
It's interesting. As I've gotten to study the Bible more and, you know, listen to other takes on Bible stories and things of that nature, it seems like drawing a line in the sand, saying who's in, who's out, that's not a new concept. That was going on.
It's old as time.
Yeah, it was always, you know, clean, unclean, Jew, Gentile, you know, all these different things. So that kind of brings me to kind of my final questions for y'all. But as you read these biblical stories, the people who were doing these things, saying who's in, who's out, you know, drawing these lines in the sand, you know, there was a definition of good and evil with Jews versus the Romans and all of that. It seems like every time Jesus just annihilates that.
Right.
And says, hey, there's another way, y'all. There's another way where you don't draw these lines in the sand. So my question is, in your interactions with the Bible, in your studying of Jesus, of the early church, is this something Jesus would have done? And I think I know the answer to that, but is this something Jesus would have done? Would he have made these public statements of, like what we've talked about?
Jesus was literally tortured to death so more people could be included. Like, that's what happened. Like, he was tortured to death, and it was no longer an Israelite thing.
What do you mean?
So the idea of faith and inclusion in this group that was the children of God and this holy and chosen group of people, to be a part of that, you had to be Jewish. You had to convert. Jesus came and broke all that, which is a reason why we don't have to be Jewish to be Jesus followers. Like, it was an inclusionary thing, which is what Paul spent his entire ministry going, trying to tell people, and why he was so against people trying to make Gentiles live up to the food laws and the all of that, that were things that made you included into the Jewish people. He was saying, no, it's good to be Jewish if you're Jewish, but you don't have to be Jewish to have communion with God anymore. Jesus made this for all nations. Jesus included everybody. Jesus went to the Samaritan woman and didn't say in that Samaritan town, all of you should become Jews. He went and loved the Samaritans as Samaritans, which is not something that was doable before.
So does the other camp look at that story specifically and say, well, he did love the Samaritan woman, but it doesn't mean he condoned her lifestyle.
I also wonder if they wouldn't say, you know, she didn't pray the prayer of salvation.
It didn't even exist. It's arbitrary. We made that up. I know. We're all supporting each other, but we're all like, ah!
I mean, I understand, but I wonder if the interpretation of that story gets lost a little bit because of the lens of, you know, belief-based Christianity, if you will. Okay, so as we're trying to land this plane, as I said, this is only the first one in a series of about three episodes, where the next episodes we'll jump more into, you know, the Bible and interpretation.
And how the Bible's used and was it meant to be used that way.
Right. So as we've kind of went through this, we've talked about these statements. Like, what is your, this is for both of you, what is your takeaway from this conversation?
You know, for me personally, I think there is beauty in the complexity of the Christ story and the gospel and the Bible as the three of us know it. There are many different perspectives, interpretations. Like, we obviously grew up in a faith tradition that was Southern Baptist, and some of the potential shortcomings of that faith tradition came to light for us. And luckily, for whatever reason, instead of just all becoming atheist and then mocking Christianity, we for whatever reason decided maybe we don't need to throw out the bath with the baby with the bathwater, or the bath itself. A lot of people, a lot of our peers, a lot of our friends did not make that decision, and I don't blame them personally. But, like, we are on this earth to love our neighbor. James, I know that you believe that wholeheartedly and you live it wholeheartedly. That is a tough, tough calling in itself. And I think it still makes Christianity compelling. So that's where I'm at right now.
Once again, I wanna make sure that like we talked about at the beginning, and like the binaries of enemy equals evil and all of that, a lot of the people who support this statement and who taught us the Bible and taught us about Jesus when we were growing up, something about the way that generation taught us and our parents' generation taught our generation enabled us to re-examine the Bible and desire deconstruction and reconstruction. And so I think there's a lot of credit that needs to be given to that generation where we, you know, disagree and butt heads with, on stuff and whatever, but something about the way they did faith has made us still care. And so I definitely think a lot of credit needs to be given for that.
Absolutely. And we're still alive as well. At least I hope we are. That's my belief, that we're still alive.
But with with these statements and this desire, I think they're just misguided. I feel like they hurt their cause. They further alienated the exact kinds of people that Jesus called us to love. And I feel like the only way I know how, through the filter of something being Christianity, how to view it as, was this like Jesus, was this beneficial, is being able to say, looking at the people it was against and the people that you disagree with and whatever, and did they feel loved from this? Because Jesus went into all of these instances where he was, you know, like the Samaritan woman that we talked about before, said, yeah, I get you're doing stuff that's, it's not good. It's not healthy for you. It's just, you've had a hard life, and I get that. But I love you. Here's hope, all of that. And in her reaction to it was running and telling people, he told me every bad thing I've ever done. And she felt loved. Do these statements do that? And I would have to say they don't. I'd say that these statements alienate the people that Jesus would have been at dinner with while you were writing that statement. These are the people that Jesus would have been washing their feet. These are the people that are the reason why Jesus was called a drunkard and all of that sort of stuff. He had skin in the game. He had relationship with hurting people. He saw people who weren't in right, healthy relationship with God, and he went and loved them into that relationship. And that's what we're supposed to do. And this drawing lines in the sand was a bad idea. The only time he drew in the sand, he kept some from being stoned to death. That's the only time he did something that might be a literal kind of drawing a line in the sand type thing. Was, hey, y'all shouldn't kill somebody. So, I don't know. I just feel like this is not Jesus. Because Jesus so fully embodied making people want to be included when they weren't. And fully embracing them. And that's just not what these things do. And I will also say, both sides are terrible at that. And the people who condemn this, we are also terrible at making the people who wrote this statement feel loved. Like we have been terrible at being Jesus to that group of people. So before we point the fingers and talk about how bad they are for not doing what the exact same thing that we're not doing, we should you know, do the whole get the plank out of our eyes.
I forgot whose quote this was, but somebody who apparently is important that I should know their name said that if you imagine a heaven that doesn't involve everyone, you're going to be really disappointed. And if that's the heaven that you're imagining, that's probably not what heaven is going to be like.
I feel like that was the Denim Kangaroo himself, JTT, wasn't it?
Was that Jonathan Taylor Thomas?
Yeah.
God, he's brilliant.
No shirt, just some overalls, flipping waffles at Waffle House.
Yeah.
You don't flip waffles. JTT does. He is that skilled.
Legitimately, though, like, we are going to be so disappointed because the people that we think are the least of these, who are in the wrong, insert the person that you are most offended by, that person is equally loved as you are. That is the gospel. That is what is incredible about what Christ taught us when he was on this earth. The least of these.
What I take from this conversation is not something I expected to take. This conversation exposed my warts more than I think the statement's warts. And similar to what you guys were just talking about, it's real easy to fall into the trap of disagreeing with something like this and then being the exact same, but yet thinking that I'm on the right side of this, so
oh yeah,
I'm good.
Like, we feel righteous talking about that, right? Like, we're like, oh, they're in the wrong.
Yeah. What came to my mind, the reason why I wanted to clarify, the reason that I immediately knew what I said wasn't great, but yet I'm still going to leave it in there because I think it's important to see that I'm not quote unquote righteous either. You know, I'm wearing it, is that Jesus died for all of us, died for them, died for me, died for you. I don't believe that they wrote that statement to hurt somebody. That is what came out of it. But I'm willing to believe that that's not why they wrote that. And in that, we're all trying to figure out what it means to live on this earth and what it means to follow Jesus and things like that. So what I take out of this conversation is that I came into this thinking that I was going to tear down these statements and just rip them apart. I mean, I had been studying these things for a while and was ready to just like hand it to them. And what actually came out of it was that I am no better. In fact, I was probably worse because I didn't have the best intentions in what I wanted to say. So even though I disagree with the statements, I realize that I need to have more grace and I need to have more mercy on people because, you know, I'm the same. And doesn't mean that I'm ever going to agree with that statement, but what it means is that I can show those people who sign that some grace, you know.
I love it, man. So to do a quick wrap up, because we're having so much fun. Wrap up.
I want you to do an actual rap wrap up, but like the really white 90s rap. My name is David and I'm here to say, like that kind of thing.
I love it. I'll work on that. I'll work on that. So y'all, thank you so much for supporting us. Without you all listening, and it's a big assumption on our part, but we're pretty sure we have some people that listen to this.
Thanks, Japan.
Thanks, Japanese folk. I'm sorry, Japan folk.
Japan people. As they prefer to be called.
They do. Preference is important. Yeah, so follow us. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. You can go to www.everythingisokay.net, and there are links to follow us on social media. We want to hear from you. We love hearing from y'all. And as Brad said on our 50th episode, absolutely give us a quick review on iTunes if you listen to iTunes podcasts.
I thought you were going to say absolutely give us money.
Yeah, absolutely throw us your dollar bills. Give us your Benjamins.
Just sign over that first check of the month.
Yep,
that you know, first whatever check. You need to do.
Yeah. No, but legitimately, give us a review. We accept 5-star reviews and primarily 5-star reviews. If you have issues, either keep them to yourself or send us an email. Give us some constructive feedback.
Yeah, if you feel like we deserve fewer than 4 stars... don't worry about reviewing. It's not worth your time.
It's not worth your time. Yeah, let us know, though. We take feedback very, very seriously, though. But that's how other people who are not in our friendship group or haven't heard from you, the listener, can find us. So we need you all to do that. And thank you so much. And then also, if you want to support us, you can go to patreon.com/everythingisokay. And for as little as $1 a month, you'll get kind of insider look into some of our extra non-edited material.
For as little as $1 a month, you can feed Brad Stare for a month.
That's right, man. For as little as $1 a month.
Isn't that what those commercials used to be? Dollar a day, you can feed a child for a month or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. We need y'all's support, though. So we obviously don't have any ads or anything on our podcast. And y'all's support helps us to keep doing what we're doing. And thank you.
This episode has been brought to you by consent. Remember, consent is important.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
It's our first ad.
So with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up. I'm Brad Stare.
I'm David Meggs.
I'm James Eisenhower.
Everything's okay, people.
I know you think it's still my fault as I boarded the first red eye. And to think we might have had it all, somewhere in a former life. It tempts me when I hear that call, and I cease to exist. Familiar faces turn to fall, take me by surprise. It's too